This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. The House Intelligence Committee heard testimony from Mark Sandy, an Office of Management and Budget official, in the impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump. Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell of California says Sandy's testimony related to a hold that the administration placed on millions of dollars of aid for Ukraine.
I'm not going to go into what he testified to, but this investigation is most importantly about $391 million in taxpayer dollars that was leveraged to ask the Ukrainians to investigate the president's political opponent.
Republican Mark Meadows of North Carolina says Sandy did not help the Democrats' case.
That the assumptions that Democrats have made and certainly the allegations that they have made have not been supported by the witnesses' testimony here today.
The committee later released transcripts of testimony from two additional White House aides, former National Security Council official Tim Morrison and Jennifer Williams, an aide to Vice President Mike Pence. Both were on a July 25th call between Mr. Trump and Ukraine's president. Protesters have set fires on bridges leading to Hong Kong Polytechnic University as they try to keep police from advancing on them. Police had shut down access to the area and masked earlier Sunday in an apparent attempt to surround protesters. At least seven people were killed and eight injured on Sunday after a gas pipeline exploded in Bangladesh. A witness says the injured were taken to a hospital and the death toll could rise as some were in critical condition. The U.S. and South Korea say they are postponing joint military drills. U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper says the move is an act of goodwill toward North Korea. The joint announcement was made in Bangkok at an Asia Defense Ministers Conference. For more on any of today's news stories, please visit us at voanews.com or use the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. Former Defense Chief Gotabaya Rajapakse has won Sri Lanka's presidential election. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
For some, Sri Lanka's new president is the man to defeat enemies of the state such as those who carried out deadly Easter Sunday attacks earlier this year. For others, he should be tried for war crimes over allegations of killings, torture and disappearances of scores of people during the final stages of a war against Tamil separatists a decade ago. Gotabaya Rajapaksa was declared the winner of Sri Lanka's presidential election on Sunday. He's the younger brother of former President Mahinda Rajapaksa. And the pair, with Gotabaya as defense chief, gave the military a free hand in 2009 to crush the Tamil Tigers and end a 26-year war.
That's Reuters' David Doyle. Iran's supreme leader is backing the government's decision to raise gasoline prices and called angry protesters who have been setting fire to public property over the hike thugs, signaling a potential crackdown on the demonstrations. Since the hike on Friday, demonstrators have abandoned their cars along major highways and joined mass protests. A large study is calling into question some of the most common practices in heart care. AP's Ben Thomas reports.
The study finds that people with severe but stable heart disease from clogged arteries may have less chest pain if they get a procedure to improve blood flow rather than just allowing medicines time to help. But it also finds a stent or heart bypass won't cut their risk of having a heart attack or dying in the following few years. The results suggest that tens of thousands of costly stent procedures and bypass operations each year are unnecessary or premature for people with stable disease. However, it is a different situation with a heart attack, when a procedure is needed right away to restore blood flow. I'm Ben Thomas.
The World Health Organization is calling for stricter regulations on the marketing and sale of e-cigarettes. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Health officials are increasingly worried about the risks posed by e-cigarettes as reported cases of deaths and illnesses from these devices spread from the United States to Europe and beyond. The World Health Organization says it is disturbed that vaping devices continue to be marketed as products that are healthy and that can wean smokers off their nicotine addiction. Vaping is an extremely profitable growth industry. The number of people using vaping devices has increased from 7 million in 2011 to 41 million in 2018. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For more on today's news, please go to the VOA website at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
If Uhuru and Raila work on a deal, and either come up with Raila as a presidential candidate or support somebody, sure, anybody else will be a joker. Will be a rank outsider. You can't stand the force between Raila and Uhuru, combined force. Anybody trying to go against that will be joking.
The Kenyan Deputy President William Ruto attacks the media.
We will have more people joining the protest action because they will feel that they are part of, on top of the political demand, there is a lot of pressure because of the reduction in terms of the takeaway salary for workers, especially in the public sector space where people last got their increment in 2016. So.
Groups call for immediate political changes in the Southern African Kingdom of Eswatini.
Things concerns really focused on is this concept of building resilience, which is making it sure that the communities have both the economic, the educational, the health facilities, that they can be resilient to these increasing climatic and crisis-affected kind of areas.
And heavy downpours in the Horn of Africa destroy life and property. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Kenyan media is coming under criticism after Deputy President William Ruto expressed concern about moves to undermine the governing party ahead of the next general election. The Deputy President was quoted as saying, "Stories being carried out by the media are masterminded to create divisions within the rank and file of the ruling Jubilee coalition." However, critics of the Deputy President say the attack on the media is unfortunate and regrettable. For reaction to the Deputy President's media attack, I reached Professor Manyora, a senior lecturer at the University of Nairobi.
The Deputy President of the Republic of Kenya is a man under siege. When a man is under siege, he sees an enemy in everybody, even trees. So I think he would want everybody to support him, everybody to sing their praise. And if media is not doing that, then automatically they become enemy. Media is not there to please him. Media are doing their job. And I don't think part of it is to please him, him included.
The Deputy President appears to be saying that stories that are usually written or broadcast by the media are sponsored by those out to divide the ruling party and wrestle power from the Jubilee coalition, the governing party. Do you think his criticism of the media is legitimate?
His criticism of the media is not legitimate because, look here, it is like saying the president is not in control of the party. Because if you are saying media can wreck the party after being bought by others, first is to imagine that those in charge of that party do not have the power to control their party. Secondly, I thought the Deputy President is a rich man. He gives so much information. Why wouldn't he also bribe the same media? I mean, I don't understand it myself.
Why do you think the Vice President sees enemies everywhere? Why do you think he is under siege? Because it appears that he wants to succeed President Uhuru Kenyatta after he serves his second full-year term.
He's under siege and his enemies in everybody for simple reason that he was so assured of automatic ascent to power that when the handshake between Raila and Uhuru happened, he was not just perplexed. It was the world collapsed under him. So from then on, he's never really been himself. He's never been steady. And I would understand it, even if it were me. You know, he was so sure that he was going to be the president. And I doubt there was anybody who would have beaten him in 2022 until this handshake happened. But from then, he's a confused man. It caught him unawares. It is not something he could believe. He has been trying to understand it and believe it. He has not. And every passing day indicates to him Uhuru is seriously out of him and that he will not support him. So he will do all these kind of things you are seeing him doing. These are things you expect from a man who is harassed.
So what do you see as his electoral prospect after President Uhuru Kenyatta complete his second year term?
Well, he has the option to go by what the president wants. If what the president wants may include him being president, then he can go by it. Or even if it includes an arrangement that brings other people on board, he could go by that kind of thinking and support the president in what it is. But he as a human being, as a Kenyan, he has no right to go in his own way. He can fight the president. I mean, if the president says this is where we are going and he chooses to go the opposite direction, he will have chosen to fight the president. He has a right to do that. It's his right. Whether he succeeds in that is or not is another story.
But does he have the coalition power to pull a coalition together to win the Kenyan presidency in a transparent election?
The coalition would be a problem to him because you don't understand Kenyan politics is highly segmented in terms of regions and cultural groups. Right? And every community has its kingpin. So as it were today, all the kingpins, all the regional heads and leaders, political leaders, working with the president in this handshake deal. So that leaves him with minor politicians, small politicians, who you can't quite trust whether they are supporting him because they believe in his cause, or because they are going for his money. But the big non-politicians are with the handshake team. So he's unlikely to get those kind of heavyweights. But they can still have a coalition of minors, small boys and girls.
So are you saying basically the handshake between former Prime Minister Raila Odinga and President Kenyatta basically hands over power, so to speak, to Raila Odinga to run for the presidency, which basically dooms the chances of the deputy president in an election?
If Uhuru Kenyatta, the president, is sincere in his dealing with Raila Odinga and is going to support him, it's a done deal. Anybody else is dead on arrival. If Uhuru and Raila work on a deal and either come up with Raila as a presidential candidate or support somebody, sure, anybody else will be a joker. Will be a rank outsider. You can't stand the force between Raila and Uhuru, combined force. Anybody trying to go against that will be joking.
Professor Manyora is a senior Kenyan lecturer at the University of Nairobi. He spoke with me from Nairobi.
Eswatini banned political parties, civil society groups, and the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, or TUKUSWA, saying the poor prevailing socio-economic challenges facing the kingdom is due to the kingdom's flawed political system. At a meeting in the capital in Mbabane Saturday, the groups resolved to begin organizing members for mass protest actions to pressure the government for political changes. The meeting came after local media reports of luxurious vehicles, including 91 BMWs and 19 Rolls Royces, purchased for King Eswatini III and his household. This after the government said it doesn't have funds to increase salaries of public sector workers. To learn more about the meeting, I reach Muzi Mlanga, Deputy Secretary for the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, or TUKUSWA.
What was agreed is that the problem that we are having in our country, the purchases of the vehicles, the hikes in bread price, the hikes in fuel prices, all of them are just symptoms of the sick political system that we are currently having in our country. Also that the challenge that we are facing is that all along our politics, those who are involved in politics, were focusing on the monarch, on the king, who's the source of this whole problem. And then we also reaffirmed that this issue must be led by political parties, because we have political parties, even though they are banned or non-functional, so to speak, in Swaziland. So they need to rally, take this forward, and we as workers will then follow them.
But Muzi, the king has said people of Eswatini, or formerly Swaziland, practice monarchical democracy. Now, your groups are saying that it is a flawed system. So what system of governance do the people of Eswatini seek?
We can use examples of countries that have got monarchs who are practicing democracy, accountability, like the UK. Next to us, we have a country called Lesotho. Most of the countries have got a monarch. We are saying we are appreciative of the fact that as Swazis, we are very intimate with the monarch. But we know that all the countries, I think the French Revolution also started more like what is happening in Swaziland. We feel that the monarch is not taking us serious.
One of the resolutions that was agreed on yesterday during the meeting is that for political parties to establish defense units to protect protesters from what you described as police brutality. Now, these political parties are banned or are not supposed to participate in elections in Eswatini. Don't you think you'll be placing these so-called defense units' life in danger?
That decision was taken because of the past police brutality, where police used to beat people up, even after, long after the protest action has ended. The resolution was that we must be able to defend ourselves. We should have marshals who will be able to defend leaders and the marchers so that they are not beaten willy-nilly.
The resolution also calls on workers' groups to begin organizing for a mass rally or demonstration to demand improved conditions for public sector workers, as well as the right to demand for a democracy. Do you think this is feasible?
We think it's feasible because you are aware that now the government has just indicated to everyone that they have money. They have, splashed a lot of money in these luxuries for the monarch. And also, we also believe that it's possible because we, as workers, if we can organize rolling protest actions around those issues, then we will have more people joining the protest action because they will feel that they are part of, on top of the political demand, there is a lot of pressure because of the reduction in terms of the takeaway salary for workers, especially in the public sector space, where people last got their increment in 2016. So,
Muzi Mlanga is the Deputy Secretary for the Trade Union Congress of Swaziland, or TUKUSWA. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. Recent heavy rainfall significantly affected parts of the Horn of Africa in the worst ways. The rains caused mudslides and flash flooding in Kenya, Ethiopia, and Somalia. The effect led to infrastructural damage, displacement, and in some cases, death. However, concern worldwide, an international aid and humanitarian agency is on the ground to help. The group is working with the affected communities to protect their homes and property in an effort to minimize the risk of waterborne diseases. For more about the aid group's work, I reach Kirk Pritchard, Concerned Worldwide's Director of Humanitarian Programs.
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say is just the scale of the problem. Over 2.5 million people have been affected by it, and it really hasn't mobilized the response and the resources needed really to reach that level of people. Adding to that is that this is an area of the world that's just recovering from a drought and nutrition crisis. So there were millions of children and pregnant and lactating women and other vulnerable groups that have just essentially gotten through a very difficult period. And now they're hit with something like this again, which compounds the problems and makes the response so much more difficult. Adding to that, I mean, there's the typical problems in the area of poor access, bad roads, additional things like that really make this a very difficult humanitarian response.
Talk to me about the work the Concern Worldwide is doing about some of these challenges to resolve them or help those residents affected by this flooding to cope with this disaster.
Yeah, and I would argue that's pretty much twofold. One is the emergency interventions, where we try to just do essentially life-saving interventions, and then some of the longer-term resilience building so that these communities aren't susceptible to it in the future because these emergencies are becoming more and more frequent. On the short term, I mean, a lot of this is around the treatment of things like acute watery diarrhea. As this flooding happens, the sanitation systems and the water systems in these areas are compromised, leading to the spread of diseases such as cholera. And then other things like early warning systems to make sure that the communities have the time to get out of the way if there's flash flooding or if a dam or levee breaks upon a river, things that allow these communities to prevent the loss of lives. In some of the longer terms, we're really working with these communities to find ways to kind of deal with these shocks and things in the long range, whether that's economic empowerment, early warning systems, different sorts of livelihoods, disaster risk reduction. It really depends on the community and their location, but we want to be able to kind of break these cycles and prevent these from recurring.
Talk to me about the case in Somalia, because we all know Somalia has been affected by militant group Al-Shabaab, and now you have them affected by this flooding. What is Concern Worldwide doing in this regard, faced with this flooding?
Yeah, actually, Somalia is one of our bigger responses in the region. So it's things like, as I mentioned, the treatment of these health facilities, but also the distribution of sandbags and other measures that can help prevent this. We work a lot with local partners in these areas, which help with some of those access worries and concerns. So even despite some of these problems and these conflicts that you alluded to, we really do still have access and the ability to get out there and reach the people that we need to.
Are there instances where staff give some of these residents cash and help them with training so that they will be able to fend for their families?
Cash is actually a major component of this response in all of our intervention areas. So Concern leads something called the Somalia Cash Consortium. And so to date, we're supporting over 12,000 people with emergency cash assistance in these. And it's actually really interesting. In Somalia, a lot of this done via mobile phones and mobile money. So it's kind of this merging of technology and financial inclusion and some of these other models in an area like Somalia where you might not think that is the case. And we actually really like working through cash. It gives communities and the people they need both the dignity to choose what they want, and it's also faster. It helps support like the local economies, and it encourages trade, and it really helps the communities get back on their feet faster and quicker than some of the, you know, more traditional mechanisms of assistance, like distributing food off the back of a truck.
What do you see Concern World doing in the next 5 to 10 years in this humanitarian work that you've been undertaking in parts of Africa?
Yeah, and I mean, that's a very good question, and it's really changing, we must say. I mean, just the frequency of these emergencies is really increasing, which makes us think about things in a different manner. I remember responding back to a Somalia famine back in 2011, and then we just had another in 2017, and, you know, currently there's another emergency here, and they're really increasing frequency. And the problem with that is it doesn't give the communities time to bounce back. Like, they don't have time to rebuild their asset bases and get their economy back up and running. So you have to think about it in that manner. So one of the things Concern's really focused on is this concept of building resilience, which is making it sure that the communities have both the economic, the educational, the health facilities, that they can be resilient to these increasing climatic and crisis-affected kind of areas.
Kirk Pritchard is Concern Worldwide's Director of Humanitarian Programs. He spoke with me from New York. A new report by leading health and safety agencies finds millions of sanitation workers in developing countries are forced to work under horrific conditions that put their health and lives at risk. The International Labour Organization, World Health Organization, WaterAid, and World Bank co-authored this study. For the VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Sanitation workers everywhere occupy the lowest rung of society and are stigmatized and marginalized because they do the dirty work that other people do not want to do. This report on the plight of sanitation workers in developing countries is being issued to raise awareness of the dehumanizing conditions under which they are forced to work. For example, the report says that sanitation workers aren't given the safety training or equipment needed to protect them when handling effluent or fecal sludge. World Health Organization spokesman Christian Lindemeyer says sanitation workers make an important contribution to public health at the risk of their own lives. Poor sanitation, he says, causes more than 430,000 deaths from diarrhea every year and is linked to the spread of other diseases such as cholera, dysentery, typhoid, hepatitis A, and polio.
Sanitation workers are the people who work in jobs such as cleaning toilets, emptying pits and septic tanks, cleaning sewage and manholes, and operating pumping stations and treatment plants. Waste must be correctly treated before being disposed of or used. However, workers often come into direct contact with human waste, working with no equipment or no protection to remove it by hand, which exposes them to a long list of health hazards and diseases.
Authors of the report say sanitation workers in developing countries largely operate in the informal sector. They labor under abusive conditions, have no rights or social protections, and are poorly paid. The study calls on countries to rectify these wrongs. It urges governments to enact laws and regulations that improve working conditions for sanitation workers and protect their safety and health. It says sanitation workers must be given the equipment and training necessary for the safe, proper disposal of waste. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
The Oscar Committee is urging Nigerian filmmakers to use more native languages in their productions. This after the U.S. Academy Awards disqualified a Nigerian entry in the International Feature Film category because the movie used too much English. While some in Nigeria's Hollywood, known as Nollywood, support the idea of more native languages in films, others argue that non-English films limit their audience reach. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Nollywood filmmaker Desmond Tomwen is aiming for a U.S. Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Award, popularly known as an Oscar, by producing a film in a native Nigerian language.
It's actually an Hausa-based film, so it's a language movie. It's not English. I've done a couple of them in English, but that was actually my first film in Hausa.
Most Nigerian filmmakers make English language movies to reach a larger audience globally, but also inside Nigeria, where the former British colony made English the official language. Filmmaker Darlington Abuda has been in the industry for years.
In Nigeria, if I do a purely language-based film, I have made my film a regional film in Nigeria. So it will not appeal or get the audience traction that it needs in the other parts of the country.
But that tide may be slowly turning after the Academy Awards this month disqualified Nigeria's first entry in the International Feature Film category. Only 11 minutes of Genevieve Nnaji's Lionheart, the first Nollywood film by Netflix, was in the native Igbo language. To qualify for the International Feature Award, at least 50% of the film's dialogue must be in a language other than English. While the rejection was roundly criticized in Nigeria, CJ Obasi, a member of the Nigerian Oscar Committee, which was set up 5 years ago, is optimistic.
If you look at the bigger picture, you realize that it's a victory in that we made a submission for the first time ever. And what that does is that it repositions, you know, the Nigerian film industry and repositions the hearts and minds of filmmakers as to how we are going to tell our stories moving forward.
Nigeria's Oscar Selection Committee says the rejection should motivate Nollywood filmmakers to create more movies in the country's over 500 native languages. But convincing Nigerian filmmakers to turn away from English, the language that ties the country together and with the world, will remain a challenge. And for some Nollywood filmmakers like Jim Ike, the language used is not the point.
If someone sits in their living room and decides where my movie should be, and what platform or what award I should get, that is on them. I've done my job. I've fed the artist in me.
While Lionheart won't make the February Academy Awards, being rejected and having the backing of Netflix are already drawing more international attention to Nollywood and what Nigerian filmmakers produce next. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impoga and music from our African collection, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. But first, Clemento Suarez is a Ghanaian actor and comedian. He is a graduate of the School of Performing Arts at the University of Ghana, Lagos. Originally from the capital, Accra, Clemento Suarez has featured in movies and music in Ghana. Suarez joins me live in the Viewer Studios here in Washington, D.C. Hello, Clemento Suarez. How are you?
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm fine. How are you too, sir?
I'm well, thank you. Yes. Why the name Suarez? You know Ghanaians hate the name Suarez because of the World Cup in South Africa between Ghana and Uruguay. Yeah, Uruguay. Why choose that name?
Yeah, but if you look at the positive side, you know, the guy laid his life down for his country. Mm-hmm. So I decided to look at that side to lay down my life.
I hear you. So yeah. When did all this begin for you?
That's acting, if I may put it. Acting has been a part of me since I was young, but because I'm naturally shy, I didn't bring it out. But until I got to senior high school, that's college, mm-hmm. yeah, then I joined the drama club, and then in Tema Secondary School. Mm-hmm. That's excuse me to say, the best miss school in West Africa. And then I moved to the University of Ghana to pursue theater arts, and mm-hmm. I majored in it. So that's where it properly started, mm-hmm. when I started doing it for commercial purposes and all.
Let me ask you this, because a lot of parents will try to prevent their children from going into the movie industry or the acting industry. How did your parents react when you decided to go into that industry?
I keep saying this, my parents, I'm lucky to have enlightened parents. They are both educationists, mm-hmm. so they know what is good for kids. I mean, you can study your science, you can study your math, and still work on your talent and get something good out of it. So I think my parents were very supportive. And that mentality too is draining down a bit, because now all the millionaires and billionaires are entertainers. Mm-hmm. You see Jay-Z, you see Cristiano Ronaldo. So everybody's pushing their children into developing their talent. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah.
But some people say in the Ghanaian entertainment industry, it doesn't pay that much. You hear musicians complaining. You hear former actors and actresses complaining. Mm-hmm. With the advent of social media, mm-hmm. Is it changing the landscape? Is it rewarding now than it used to be?
A lot of things are changing now in Ghana, because now, like you said, social media is really rewarding. First, you do something and only a group of people are getting it. But now you put it out there on social media and everybody is getting it, and you are getting shows mm-hmm. where you've never even dreamt of going. And so mm-hmm. I think social media has changed a lot of things. The people who, I mean, our predecessors were not so lucky to have enjoyed social media that much. But even them, they still enjoy something. Maybe planning and investment and other things didn't go their way. But now the new crop of people, looking at Star Cordier, looking at Majid, Ajay Anand, everybody is doing something aside the acting. So when you get the money, you invest in something else. And even when you are relaxed and you're not acting or you're not singing, the money is growing for you.
In the next 5 to 10, 15 years' time, mm-hmm. if I may ask you, where do you see the Ghanaian entertainment industry in the next 5 to 10 years' time?
In the next 5 to 10 years' time, if we are growing as we are now mm-hmm. and we are steadily focused, mm-hmm. I pretty much think we will be discussing what we earlier on discussed about the Nollywood film that was, how do you call it, that was disqualified. Mm-hmm. It's either we are going to be disqualified or we are going to be nominated and we are going to win awards, because I think the movie industry is moving very fast and we are learning. And so in the next 5, 10, 15 years, Ghana is going to be on the map real good.
What makes Suarez stand out in the Ghanaian entertainment industry?
It's just God's favor. I don't know what I do that makes me different from the others, because I'm not a full-time comedian or full-time comic actor like other people are doing every day they're doing. But still, when you mention names, you're going to mention my name. And so this is a whole different thing. I think this is God's own plan for me, God's favor for me. And that's it.
Where do you draw inspiration for your work?
I draw lots of inspiration from nature. And I also draw inspiration from what goes on in the country. My audience in Ghana are mostly inward. Their attention are not mostly outside. And so you use what's inside for them, say political, social, sports, music, anything. You use it for them and they enjoy you so much. So I sit down, observe, and then I create.
Before we go, what is your message to your fans back home in Ghana and here as well? And where do you see yourself in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, my message to my people in Ghana, thank you so much for your support and your patronage. I mean, when I do shows in the National Theater, they come in their numbers and support. When I do movies, they patronize. And so thank you all. God bless you. In the next 5 years, I know I'm still going to be here. I'll be coming here every year to have interview, because probably I'll be nominated for awards in Hollywood, Oscar, Golden Globe, and all. And so big thank you to all my team. That's Alan Templeman, he holds me down in Ghana. Alan Templeman, Seth Ferdinand Godwin, and then Bridget Buama, and my sweet darling Sylvia, and then my mother, Sarah in Texas. They're holding us down. I mean, all Ghanaians, social media, my followers, especially on Instagram, they are so wonderful. Facebook, they are awesome. Thank you all. Keep supporting Ghana and Ghana movie industry.
Thank you very much. That was Clemente Suarez, a Ghanaian actor and comedian. He joined me live in the Viewer Studios right here in Washington, D.C. And it's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In football, on Friday, a lower-ranked Mauritania forced a goalless draw in their first Group E match in 2021 Africa Cup of Nations qualifying in Rabat. Morocco are ranked 42nd in the world, 63 places above Mauritania. Also on Friday, Tunisia thrashed Libya 4-1. Tanzania were late 2-1 winners over Equatorial Guinea, and it was a goalless draw between Zimbabwe and Botswana. Morocco are away to bottom Group E side Burundi in Bujumbura on Tuesday. Central African Republic, who have never qualified for the Cup of Nations, top the table after a 2-0 home win over Burundi on Wednesday. Tunisia, who finished fourth at the 2019 tournament in Egypt, made an impressive Group J debut by beating North African neighbors Libya 4-1 in red near Tunis on Friday night. Tunisia lead on goal difference after Tanzania, who came from behind, score late to beat Equatorial Guinea 2-1. Host Zimbabwe dominated possession in the first half of their Group H game at the National Sports Stadium in Harare, but Botswana held firm and the game ended goalless. Ivory Coast and Madagascar both produced 1-0 victories on Saturday in the first round of Group K matches. Earlier in the day, Madagascar beat Ethiopia 1-0 to get their 2021 Nations Cup qualifying campaign off to a solid start. Madagascar made their debut at the 2019 Nations Cup finals in Egypt. They famously beat Nigeria on their way to reaching the quarterfinals before losing to Tunisia. The top two sides in 11 of the 12 groups will all advance to the 2021 finals in Cameroon. Cameroon qualify for the finals as hosts, but are taking part in the qualifying campaign to gain competitive match practice, which means just one team from Group F will progress to the finals. And the two Egyptian sides left in the Confederation Cup have been drawn the same group after last week's draw in Cairo. Pyramids and Al Masry are both in Group A alongside Mauritania's Nouadhibou and Enugu Rangers from Nigeria. The group stage will begin on November 1st and run through until March next year. The top two teams from each of the four groups will progress to the quarterfinals. None of the 16 teams left in the tournament have won it since its inception in 2004. Elsewhere, Cameroon and Zambia will play each other in January to decide who will automatically qualify for the women's football tournament at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. The losers of that game will face Chile in a playoff for another place at the Games. Unlike the men's Olympic football tournament, the women's event is open to full national teams rather than under-23 sides. It would be Zambia's first ever appearance in the women's Olympic football tournament, while Cameroon played at the 2012 Games in London, where they lost all three of their games. And in athletics, five finalists for the male 2019 award have been announced. Among the finalists is Eliud Kipchoge, the 35-year-old Kenyan, who became the first athlete to run a marathon in under 2 hours in Vienna, Austria in October. Kipchoge also set the London Marathon course record of 2 hours, 2 minutes and 37 seconds earlier this year. Others are Americans Sam Kendricks and Noah Lales, Uganda's Joshua Cheptegei, and Norwegian hurdler Carsten Walholm. Cheptegei won the world cross-country title, Diamond League 5,000 meters title, and set a world leading time of 26:48.36 in the 10,000 meters, while Walholm won the 400 meters hurdles title, clocked the second fastest time in history of 46.92 seconds, and went undefeated this year. Paul Volta Kendricks won a world title, cleared the world leading 6.06 meters, and won 12 outdoor competitions this year, while Lyles won world 200 meters and 4x100 meters titles, and moved fourth on the world all-time 200 meters fastest list with a time of 19.50 seconds. And marathon world record holder Brigid Kosgei is one of five finalists for the Female World Athlete 2019 Award. Last month, the Kenyan broke Paul Redcliffe's 16-year-old world record, running a time of 2 hours 14 minutes 4 seconds to win the Chicago Marathon. The 25-year-old Kosgei also became the youngest winner of the London Marathon in April. The male and female World Athletes of the Year will be announced live on stage at the World Athletics Awards 2019 in Monaco on Saturday, November 23rd. Finally, Abraham Kiptum has been banned for 4 years over an anti-doping violation, according to the Athletics Integrity Unit. The Athletics Integrity Unit, which oversees integrity issues in athletics, including doping, had provisionally suspended the 30-year-old Kenyan on April 26 for an athlete biological passport violation. Kiptum's ban starts from that date. All his results going back to October 13, 2018, including a half-marathon world record of 58 minutes and 18 seconds that he had set in Valencia later that month, have been disqualified. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. Yeah. Yep. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. You're hearing from Maslay featuring Ali Kiba with Bemba. Samira Said come up next with Ellie Benner, and then Akon featuring Keys Daniel with Take Your Place. End it all. Niambie tuwakomeshe, tuwakomeshe vishadai, wavimbe wateseke. We nipende tu, nipena nyota tembele. Wacha wiviga kula, nebe tushikane tuwakime. We ni doktor mimgojwa ndomana, mkikwona mweza koni na pona. Umenija akili ni ndomana, kutaja mweza kokila ngoma. Takata na penzi lako,
Nantagata tanatu Kini nyema icho licho kuwa nacho Haridhika ridhika Haridhika na humbala Na kwa hidi ntamufa Kijia kuliko sailo pendi lako Bembea Mahabuba bembea Oh Bembea Na kuruhusu ninginia Kwenye moyo wangu Bembea Lazizi bembea
Ulivyo mtamura tele Shikari usongeze Juzu na uzuri unao na shiba Mahaba legeze Kini kusto na sisimua Janja bingwa kusasamua Meniweza mtoto akishua Shira zangu zoto ratatua Ndongara na kubenda Palipu ufa tujenge Usisikize wabambewe Penipende ni kupende Nando mana na kubenda Tuifiche yo siri Tusune sitha hiri Wanga wana subiri waone utavyo ni mwaka
And that was Sunday Music Spot. I hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here, the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Is there a risk that South Sudan will be abandoned by the international community in the manner in which Somalia was abandoned following the ouster of Siad Barre and the emergence of the warlords? The developments in South Sudan warrant the raising of these questions. When South Sudan achieved its independence after it had seceded from the Sudan, the newest country in the international system was received with open arms. There was much goodwill and hope that the people of South Sudan will be able to live in peace and tranquility. But soon, there were disappointments. Ethnic rivalries emerged, and there were governmental breakdowns. Refugees flowed. Well, the international community came together to assist the government and the people of South Sudan, and they worked out another arrangement for the people and the government to put things together again. Regrettably, despite all the efforts, despite targeted sanctions, the political class in South Sudan has demonstrated that it lacks the political will to create the environment for its people to live in peace and tranquility. And the latest frustration and disappointment was announced last week. It was announced that President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, his first vice president and leader of the opposition, were unable to reach the deadline of the 12th of November, and that they have given themselves another 100 days to tackle the outstanding issues such as a unified army, agreement on the number of states in the republic, and an agreed governmental structure. Many experts on South Sudan believe that another 100 days will not do the job, so long as the political leaders lack the political will to reach accommodation among themselves. In these circumstances, it is necessary for the international community to examine the possibility of thinking outside the box. That means that one should look at South Sudan the way the United Nations approached Somalia in the dark days after the departure of Said Barre. Many will forget that it was only the risk taken by the United Nations to enter Somalia to begin the process of peaceful negotiations under difficult circumstances that created the foundations, which was risky and difficult, that has now made it possible for Somalia to begin to see some light at the end of the tunnel, to the point where many powers are now competing for advantages in Somalia. So how do we create a situation in South Sudan to change the chaotic situation that now prevails? It may be necessary for the African Union, after consultation with IGAD, to consider calling an international conference that will have the participation of the 5 permanent members of the Security Council, the Secretary General of the United Nations, and the President of the General Assembly. Also to be invited will be the political leaders in South Sudan and grassroots representatives. That will be very important to have them in the conference. And they will have to think outside the box. That means that perhaps they might think for some interim arrangements that will bring other forces into South Sudan with some firm peacekeeping enforcement forces that will tackle those issues mentioned before on the unified army, states, and others. And after they have worked out the arrangement, to work out plans for elections. This has been done in all parts of the Africa and in Liberia, for example. But it seems that only a radical thinking out of the box can now save South Sudan. It becomes necessary because the people of South Sudan decide they deserve to live in peace and tranquility and not be always on the edge of the outbreak of another civil war. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nelson Lopez, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a single stick may smoke, but it will not burn. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa. Oh,